I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Hey, don't you get the feeling that election year Thanksgivings are just getting more and more exciting? The conversation's more spirited, the marketplace of ideas is playing out by the gravy, everyone is ready to explode at each other and go home early, and hey, you'll get the house cleaned and get to bed at a decent hour. But if you're hoping for a less thrilling Thanksgiving, one where people are just coming together and telling each other how grateful they are and having a big dinner and several slices of pie, we've got a show for you this weekend. You can save the arguments for Black Friday. America's Test Kitchen pops in with an incredibly simple way to make gravy. Kristen McGlory, the collector of genius recipes, is here to help you build a dessert safety net just in case. And we have an anthropologist explaining why your pumpkin pie is almost literally a miracle. But our first guest is the hardest working woman in food show business. To know Carla Hall is to love her, even if knowing her just means you watched her on Top Chef or The Chew. She's got a new book called Carla Hall Soul Food about the two different sides of soul food, and she's here with me today. Carla!
Francis!
It is so great to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So your new book, congratulations, is called Carla Hall Soul Food, Everyday and Celebration. So
yes.
The subtitle is key. What are some of the celebration foods in your family these days? And are they different than what you grew up with?
No, they're actually the same. They are smothered chicken, maybe not so much pork now as it was when I was growing up, because there was always some ham. But I still love ham, but my sister and brother-in-law don't eat ham, but I still love a beautiful glazed ham. Mm. And mac and cheese, candied yams, rolls for sure. Whenever we have Thanksgiving and Christmas, you know, I make rolls and the family loves it. Lots of desserts, pecan pie, caramel cake, coconut cake, triple lemon layer cake.
That's a lot of cake.
That's a lot of cake. It's a lot of cake.
And these are dishes. Are they dishes that, you know, you've had in your family for generations, or are you sort of adding to the list?
Most of those are the things that we grew up eating that everyone expects. My sister will always say, every Thanksgiving, every Christmas, let's have something healthy.
Yeah.
And I remember one Thanksgiving. She was saying, okay, let's do Thanksgiving at your house. I'm like, okay, fine. But I can't cook because I'm working at the Washington Club and we have a big dinner that day and I just won't have time to cook. So you can bring the food to my house.
Okay.
She said, I want vegetables. I'm like, okay. So that morning she comes with a grocery bag of vegetables. And I'm like, where's the other food? And there was nothing. I mean, there was nothing. And I'm like, what are we going to eat? So I went back to my job and got raided the refrigerator, got the food that I had prepared for an event, and then brought it back home, and that was Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, I'm sure it was delicious, but then like people show up the next day and be like, we're 20 portions short.
No, we had already eaten that food, so it was all leftovers.
But, okay, that's cool.
It was cool. But I was like, what was lost in translation about you cooking and bringing the food over and then coming in with a grocery bag of raw ingredients?
But actually, it's interesting here. Like, I love that idea of eating vegetables on Thanksgiving because, let's face it, it's a harvest festival, right? So,
yes.
Like, there actually should be a lot that represents the harvest and not just starches and the, I mean, we all love that stuff, the mashed potatoes, the turkey and all that stuff. But I keep thinking about the distinction that you make in your book, the subtitle, Everyday and Celebration, in connection with the title being Soul Food. Because I feel like I didn't grow up with soul food, but everything I understood about soul food, everything I thought soul food was, the stereotypes of soul food, were kind of all based on the idea that celebration foods actually became everyday foods.
Right. But when you're growing up, you can't afford to eat that food every day. And also, historically, those foods weren't available every day. Maybe you had, you decided to kill your chicken that you needed for eggs one time a year, and you might fry it. As people became more affluent and they could afford more of those foods, they started having them more frequently, and they had them every day. And those were the dishes that everyone loved. So when restaurants popped up, you know, if you have a restaurant, you're going to, of course, make the foods that were celebration foods, because this is when you're bringing other outsiders to the table.
Sure.
And you want to attract them with all of this fat and salt and heaviness and starches, and because people love it. Exactly. Yeah. What you said. But were people actually eating like that every day? Absolutely not.
Right.
And that's why I really wanted to make the distinction with the everyday foods and the celebration foods.
Yeah. So let's get to the everyday part. So much of your book is about vegetables.
Yes.
So much of your book is about lighter eating, but not in a, okay, here's for your diet plan.
Exactly. I mean, I didn't want to have a diet book. I wanted to have foods that were just as delicious. And one of the turning points in the book, one of the dishes that I took, which is stewed tomatoes and okra, which is hugely popular, you know, around the table. And most of my Southern friends, that's one of their favorite dishes. And I said, okay, let me take that dish and lighten it up. Well, one, because I don't really like okra.
You heard it here.
You heard it here. And I have six recipes
oh
with
God.
Okra in the cookbook. So if I don't like something, I think of how can I make it? Why don't I like it? I don't like it because it's slimy.
Okay.
So how am I going to treat it so that it isn't slimy? And I think that's why a lot of people don't like okra.
Mm-hmm.
So the recipe with the stewed tomatoes and the roasted okra, that was my answer to the stewed tomatoes and okra. And I make this very brothy soup with tomatoes and onions and garlic and all of these aromatics and bay leaves. And then I roast the okra rounds until they're charred. And then put it into the soup as it is in a bowl, not before. The okra permeates the broth and it becomes this exact taste, I think, as stewed okra and tomatoes. But the textures are palatable for me.
Yeah.
And so it's a very light dish. It's a very quick dish. And you can have it in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of dishes that I'm making.
Yeah.
For every day.
But now it's time to celebrate.
Yes.
Because it's Thanksgiving.
It's exactly right.
What's going to be on your Thanksgiving table?
So the new thing that's on my Thanksgiving table that we didn't do when I was growing up, we always had yeast rolls. And they're, of course, potato rolls. But why not put sweet potatoes in them?
Oh.
Make them sweet potato rolls. And
look
so now they're this beautiful color and they are slightly sweeter and they have
moisture, maybe?
The moisture, yes. And the thing about the rolls, I call them squishy rolls.
Huh.
So you just underbake them slightly so that they kind of stick to the roof of your mouth. Like taking that whole roll and it's sticking to the roof of your mouth. And I love it so much. Yes.
Okay, so sweet potato squishy rolls.
Sweet potato squishy rolls and a baked chicken. And I'm saying baked chicken, but instead of the chicken that's in the book, you can do this with turkey.
Okay.
So you have your turkey pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer dark meat.
Okay, so not the whole shebang.
Not the whole shebang. Maybe there's only a small group of people, mm-hmm. so you don't want to cook the whole turkey.
Sure, sure.
So turkey wings, turkey legs, turkey thighs.
Next.
And yes, oh my God, let's bring in the necks.
Come on, girl, soul food.
Come on. Okay, you know a little bit about soul food. You're going to take all of that. You're going to take loads of onions, really thinly sliced, garlic. You're going to marinate the meat in some paprika, a little bit of cayenne pepper, some thyme. You're going to just marinate all of that. And then you're going to put everything in a roasting pan.
Uh-huh.
Or if you have a huge like Dutch oven,
sure.
that you want to just put everything in there. But it has to be flat. The pieces can't be stacked on each other.
Okay, sure.
So you take that, a little bit of chicken stock or turkey stock. And if you want some chilies or habanero because you want a little more spice, you can put that in there too. You put the lid on and then you let that baby cook slowly until all of that moisture and the juices from the turkey and the chicken stock and the onions and everything sort of becomes one, and you just nurse it until it is just falling off the bone.
Yeah.
And then you take the turkey, you take the skin off and you just pull it and then you mix it in that sauce. And that becomes this beautiful, saucy, pulled turkey yumminess
yeah.
that all goes on top of your stuffing.
Yeah.
Right? And there's no dry turkey situation yeah. with this.
And you have a stuffing, a dressing that you like also.
I do. So one of the ones that, and actually this is new, and I haven't tried this with my family before, and this is spoon bread stuffing.
Mm.
You know spoon bread, where you take cornmeal and eggs and egg whites and you just whip it all together?
Like grits, but baked.
Exactly. That's such a good analogy. I never really thought about it that way because I just love having grits in their own category.
Yeah.
But I thought, what if you use the poultry seasoning? So instead of having your separate cornbread that you have to make for your dressing,
right,
you do it all at once. So you have the cornmeal and the poultry seasoning, and then you have the corn and you have the eggs, and you just stir all of this together and you have the milk and everything. And then you put this in your baking dish and you bake it, and then boom, it's not this two-step process.
And then you just pour that smothered turkey all over it.
Yes.
That sounds
really
good.
Oh my gosh, I'm so hungry.
Thank you so much. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you for having me. This is so much fun.
It's a pleasure. Carla Hall's new book is Carla Hall's Soul Food. You can find those recipes she talked about, sweet potato rolls, spoon bread dressing, and baked chicken with pan gravy, you know, the one she said you can do with turkey, at splendidtable.org. And coming up next...
Anything that goes wrong, you can fix one way or another, whether it's about hiding it cleverly, rebranding the dessert as something else entirely, or in some cases of everything just going totally wrong, having a plan B that you can bust out at the last minute.
That's Kristen McGlory from Food 52, ready to help disaster-proof your Thanksgiving dessert. And after that, don't miss the life-changing gravy recipe from America's Test Kitchen. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. For years, Kristen McGlory has written a genius column for Food 52 called Genius Recipes. They're the recipes she's collected from authors and chefs that can change the way you cook. You know, the ones that are simpler than you ever could have imagined, or ones that you make once and you know you have to memorize and make over and over again, or just the ones that make you go, oh, that's how you do it. Anyway, she's got a new collection of these recipes called Genius Desserts. So, of course, we had to go to their test kitchen and get some pre-holiday pie pointers. So, hi, Kristen. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for being here.
Here at beautiful Food 52 Studios. So, we are brethren in that we are both in the business of trying to help people on their Thanksgiving days while they're cooking their hearts out for their friends and family. We do Turkey Confidential, which is a live two-hour show where people call in and be like, oh my God, my turkey's still frozen. And we say, maybe serve them something else. And like try to find 45 creative ways of saying that. But you at Food 52 have had a live hotline on Thanksgiving for how long?
Oh my gosh. I think since about the time that we launched, maybe not in 2009, but a good going on a decade now.
Yeah.
And our hotline is live all year round, but Thanksgiving is when it really gets going. The community's there to answer questions from other home cooks, but we also want to make sure that no question sits for longer than 10 minutes. We all take the responsibility really seriously, as I'm sure you do, and we get a lot of the turkey defrosting.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to talk to you specifically about desserts, because you have a new book, Genius Desserts, and because you are in the business of finding genius recipes. So I'm like a fairly chill cook. That's a lie. I just cooked dinner for 20 of my family and I was freaking out the entire time. But I am a far less chill baker, and I imagine there's probably a lot of people who feel the same way. But I want to know, over the 9 years you've been doing this Thanksgiving hotline, what are the pie issues that people come screaming about?
All kinds of stuff. Their filling is too soggy, or their crust has crumbled or is dry, or custard pies have their own special hairballs with, you know, if it cracks or if it isn't set, and, you know, no one's sure when exactly it's going to be set. There's lots of anxiety around pie, and between the hotline and this cookbook and kind of everything we do at Food 52, we would love to make it as chill as possible for everyone by both giving them solutions to every problem we can think of, mm-hmm. but also just the pep talk of like, anything that goes wrong, you can fix one way or another, whether it's about hiding it cleverly, rebranding the dessert as something else entirely, or in some cases of everything just going totally wrong, having a plan B that you can bust out at the last minute.
Yeah. What's a good rebranding?
Like, say you like the look of the filling of your pie, but you don't like the look of the crust. You could scoop out the filling and turn it into a trifle. Or if it's a fruit pie, put it into a shallow dish and put a crumble over the top, and suddenly it's a fruit crisp. So you can have some of these backup plans in mind, you can hide.
Okay, so tell me about your genius hide for a pie that got cracked in the oven.
So you could certainly hide it with whipped cream, easy. But sure. What I really love doing is basically you mix up a pecan praline that you smear over the top and broil, and then that disguises everything you would want to disguise. And it's basically like pecan pie meets pumpkin pie.
Ooh! That's so good!
It's really good.
Show me.
Sure, okay. I will show you. So we have a totally intentionally cracked pumpkin pie. We totally meant to do it. And I also have in front of me some chopped pecans, some brown sugar, mm-hmm. a little bit of melted butter.
Okay.
And just a little bit of cream.
Okay.
So I'm just literally stirring these things together, and they look like kind of the goo from pecan pie, the good stuff. Yeah.
But a little softer, a little more mm-hmm. liquid.
Yeah, so all you do is just scoop that over your pumpkin pie.
Your fully baked pumpkin
your
pie.
Your fully serviceable pumpkin pie.
Yeah, you're already beautiful in its own way, but slightly cracked pumpkin
but
pie.
But maybe, yeah, just a little cracked. And actually, I discovered that there are a lot, like over a million pumpkin pecan pie hybrids on the internet when I started researching this, and I was shocked. But this is the only one I found where you take a fully complete pumpkin pie and
top it.
Yes. Yeah. So others, you know, you have to get the layers just right, bake them at the right amount of time. This one, you take your fully done pie and then just broil it for a couple minutes until the top is sizzly.
Yeah.
But you do have to make sure, because we don't want to invite more Thanksgiving disasters, you do have to make sure that you have covered the crust with foil.
Okay.
To protect it from charring.
Yeah, this thing looks like my mom at the hair salon.
Yes.
So yeah, okay, so you've now smeared this beautiful pecan business all over the mm-hmm. filling of the pie. Mm-hmm. You have covered the entire crust in aluminum foil.
Yes.
And now
we go to the oven where the broiler's going, and we have a rack 6 inches below.
Beautiful.
And then, very importantly, we don't walk away at this point.
Okay.
Because this happens very fast. And actually, you can even just leave the oven open if you just want to like really be monitoring.
Oh, just like watch it broil.
Yeah. Because what you'll see is the brown sugary business will start to bubble. And if your broiler's a little uneven, or if it's got that really direct stream of heat down the middle or something, you can just use your pot holders and rotate the pie as needed. And just watch for it to get bubbly and the nuts to look a little more golden.
Yeah.
And that's it.
It's not really rocket science, right? Like once it starts bubbling, is that kind of good?
That's
or
it.
You need to let it go for a minute after it bubbles?
Yeah,
or?
And then you could serve it warm and gooey if you want. I like to let it cool again so that the top gets a little bit like a crystalline crunchy crust on top.
Like a brulee. Like a creme brulee.
Yeah.
Sweet!
Yeah.
But yeah, so the beauty of having this cool, though, is like you said, that sugary topping will chill, literally mm-hmm. will chill, it will cool down, and then it will have that crackly, brulee, mm-hmm. crunchy kind of texture, right?
Yeah.
Right on.
Okay, so let's go in and get a slice.
The sound of that crust is just outlandish. Shall we?
We shall. So, when I first heard about this, I thought, pecan and pumpkin, that's a little much. But I actually, after I tasted it, realized they really complement each other nicely.
What you don't hear at home is me shaking my head. No. you only want them together forever.
Because you've got the crackly sweet top, you've got the really smooth pumpkin, the spice, the fall flavors. You know, the pumpkin is not too sweet, so mm-hmm. they balance each other out really nicely, I think.
Yeah. This is not a fix. Like, I want to do this all the time.
And you totally can, and it's really handy, actually, if your family, some people want pecan, some people want pumpkin, and you can't be bothered to make both, this is the perfect solution.
Yeah. Okay, so real talk.
Yes.
Not everyone's going to make a pumpkin pie. If you have another kind of pie, would this work?
Well, certainly sweet potato. That's an easy...
Bingo.
Easy swap. You know, it'd be great on apple, actually. Say your top crust looks a little wonky, your lattice was not what you imagined, pull the lattice off, put the praline on top, and then...
Broil away.
Broil away, yeah. It becomes apple, pecan, praline pie.
Gorgeous. Okay, so say everything is a disaster. You tried to broil the pie, and you walked away, and even that's burnt. Oh my God, I have no dessert to offer my guests. What do you say, Kristen?
I say, as long as you have three ingredients on hand, you can have dessert anytime you need it with these cookies from Dory Greenspan. She calls them the cookies that she makes when she hears a friend's coming over and she has nothing on hand. Mm-hmm. I call them the cookies that you can make and they're ready before the oven beeps, because you just stir three ingredients together with a fork, scoop them onto a sheet, and you hope that your oven's preheated by now.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Sure. Okay.
And the three ingredients are, you have one egg.
Yes, one egg, some sliced almonds, and some sugar. That's it. Yep, watch me go.
Okay, broken egg.
Broken egg, sugar.
Pour the sugar. You're not even whisking the eggs.
I'm just together. The sugar and egg together.
Okay, so with a fork, you're just mixing the sugar and egg.
Mm-hmm. And
this is crazy.
She says to do this for about a minute, but just until it looks a little bit thicker.
Okay.
And, you know, kind of your sugar needs to dissolve a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd say that looks a little thicker. And now the almonds go in.
Uh-huh.
And then just give that a stir until they're coated. And then you'll immediately scoop it.
You're done. You're putting them on the baking sheet right now. That was it. I mean, it still needs to bake.
It still needs to bake for about 20 minutes at 325. So that's when you have time to like throw your dishes in the dishwasher and make some tea for your friend or whatever.
Yeah.
And because they're only these three ingredients, they happen to be gluten-free, dairy-free. You can make them nut-free if you use big coconut flakes instead. So for anyone who's coming for Thanksgiving, you're pretty set.
Yeah.
I'm just taking a tablespoon and like filling it 2/3 full and just scooping that onto this parchment lined baking sheet, and then take a fork and just kind of flatten them a little bit to help them along with into their like cookie shape.
Yeah, yeah.
So these go into a preheated oven for 20 minutes at 325, and you have your magical three ingredient cookies. And then bake those off, and I have the cookies here for you to try.
There we go.
So we don't have to wait 20 minutes.
They're super delicate looking. Like even when you pick them in their hand, they feel so light. That's what it sounds like if you break it apart. Oh, so good.
Yeah, they're very light. They're meringue-like, even though you didn't have to whip the whites separately. They've got a bit of a meringue-y quality to them.
Yeah, like how they sort of puffed in the oven and just like the very edge of the egg just sort of set around and made like a really beautiful crisp coating on these almonds. This is so lovely. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you.
And may all your Thanksgiving desserts come exactly the way you want them. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Kristen McGlory's new book is called Genius Desserts. Find the recipes for that no-stress pie dough, pumpkin pie with pecan crunch, and Dory's Almond Crackle Cookies at splendidtable.org. So obviously, the number one freakout cause around Thanksgiving is the turkey. But whatever you think about brining or deep frying or high heat versus low heat, the fact is that the best insurance policy for any kind of turkey mishap is just to have a great gravy and a boatload of it.
Lon Lam, who I'm not related to, but now I wish I was, came up with a brilliant way to make a killer gravy that you can do way ahead of time. And the really super smart part of it is that you don't have to stand there and brown any turkey parts. She's a test cook at America's Test Kitchen, and this is their new go-to method. Here's Sally Swift getting the technique.
Hey, Lon, happy almost Thanksgiving.
Happy almost Thanksgiving to you.
I want to talk to you today about some of the things that we do on Thanksgiving Day that are a little more unconventional, and I have a story for you.
Okay.
My mother, who was a whack job, but very interesting, she would save chicken skin all year and freeze it, and then on Thanksgiving, she would thaw it out, and she would put an extra layer of skin all over the turkey that we would spend the day picking little crispy bits off. And I am telling you, it looked like hell. I mean, it looked like a taxidermied. I don't even know. It looked absolutely disgusting. That turkey breast was unbelievable from all that basted fat.
That sounds awesome. I would happily pick off bits of skin and taste that during the day.
It was a strange approach. But sometimes things need to be done differently, which is why you are here today, because you have a new technique for gravy that is going to change the world. Tell us about it.
So I do have a new technique for gravy. It does not involve chicken skin, but it does involve turkey skin. And that skin is actually one of the keys to really great turkey flavor in your stock.
I mean, the issue with gravy is that, like, so you pull the bird off and then you set it on a cutting board and then you, like, frantically make this gravy. I mean, there's got to be, that can't be right.
Yeah. So what you're doing when you make gravy is you're taking those drippings from the bird and you're diluting it with mm-hmm. stock, and then you thicken it with a roux. Mm-hmm. And it might taste pretty good if you've got good drippings, but if you don't have drippings, what do you do?
Exactly. So what do you do?
So you make a really, really turkey-forward stock, and that is going to provide all the flavor you need so that you don't need drippings. I mean, you can add them if you have them, but mm-hmm. your turkey stock is going to provide all of the flavor. And because it's providing the flavor, you don't have to have a roasted bird in drippings. You could make this a couple days in advance or even a couple weeks in advance.
Excellent. So how do you go about it?
So I kind of tossed out a lot of what we know about making gravy and started over. And step one is to ditch the saucepan. Instead of just browning your neck and giblets in a saucepan and then adding some broth to make the turkey stock, mm-hmm. We use a Dutch oven instead. And it's because a Dutch oven is so much broader on the bottom. And that's a lot of surface area for browning all those turkey juices that you're pulling from your neck and giblets. Mm-hmm. And all of that browned stuff, that fond, is going to be flavoring your stock. And then instead of just using the neck and giblets, we're also going to use some turkey skin and turkey fat. And your turkey always has extra bits and bobs that yeah. you have to trim off.
Yeah,
instead
exactly.
instead of throwing them out, use them to make your stock.
Okay.
Now, instead of kind of trying to brown them and tend to them as they color, we're going to start by putting them in the pot and adding a bunch of broth. And we're going to boil it. And what happens there is you're heating up all of the pieces on all sides really mm-hmm. fast. And that pulls out a ton of turkey juices. And then when that stock evaporates away from the pot, all of those juices brown all at the same time. And this fond just appears in about a minute.
Wow, that fast.
Yeah, so it's maybe 20 minutes of simmering and you can be doing other stuff. You don't
right.
have to pay attention. But you'll start to hear some sizzling and popping, and that's how you know that the fond is starting to form and that you need to pay attention. And then you just move on. You add your vegetables, cook them a little bit, add your broth, bring it to a simmer to let all those flavors meld, and you're done.
Just to be clear, so you are literally putting uncooked chicken neck and your trimmings and everything in the stock, in the pot, and boiling that down until the liquid's gone, and mm-hmm. then that is your base. That's your brown base.
Yeah, that's it. It's,
wow,
it's
that is, I would never have done that.
It's really hands-off until the very end, which I really like. And you, as long as you don't have the music cranked in your kitchen, it'll tell you when you it's time to pay attention.
Huh. And then do you need to thicken it with a roux?
You do. So after you've got your broth and you've strained it, it's just a matter of taking some butter and flour and browning it. By browning your roux, you get a little bit of extra flavor. You get this kind of rich nuttiness that just kind of enhances the savoriness of your turkey. And then you whisk in your broth. And if you have drippings, you whisk those in as well. And you're done. And that's
it. You're just layering turkey on turkey on turkey on turkey. It sounds delicious. And so sane. A good gravy at Thanksgiving is just an amazing thing. And it's done.
Yeah. I was having a conversation with a friend recently, and he said, let's be honest, people go to Thanksgiving for the gravy and the pie.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Ilan, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Lon Lam is a test cook at America's Test Kitchen, and you can find that recipe for game-changing gravy at splendidtable.org. Coming up, your calls, and a little mind-bending conversation starter about pumpkins. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. All right, let's talk. You can always call us 1-800-537-5252. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can always email us too, contact@splendidtable.org. Let us know what you're working on in the kitchen and what you're trying to figure out. All right, we have Alma calling from Boston. Hey, Alma.
Hi. So I always host Thanksgiving and trying to figure out how to get the guests light, tasty appetizers to enjoy before the big meal, but then don't want them to be full by the time we serve the turkey. So I was wondering if there are, you know, any tasty yet light and not too complicated appetizers that you would suggest that I serve.
All right. So light, you know, I nothing about the Thanksgiving meal is known for being light. So so I think this is a smart thing to think about. Like, oh, if you're going to do something before it, what would you do? And I got it. Are you ready? Do you like squash? Like butternut squash or, you know, like some like heirloom hard squashes like that?
Yeah. Cool.
Okay, so this is what I'm thinking. It's simple. You can do a lot of this ahead of time. And you can even set it out for people to sort of help themselves, right? But I'm thinking, do this. You take some really nice butternut or other hard squash that you like.
Okay.
Cube it, not super tiny, maybe like dice-sized pieces. Toss with salt, pepper, olive oil, roast it in one layer in a sheet tray in a hot oven, like a 425 or a 450 oven. Get a little color, probably only on one side, doesn't have to color both sides. Get some nice flavor in there and get them nice and tender and cooked, but not mushy, right? And then what I would do is I would take some nice ricotta cheese and in a food processor with some maybe fresh thyme leaves or maybe some sage, some salt, a little bit of olive oil just for a little richness. And I would do a little honey, not to make it super sweet, but just for like a, you know, just a little balancing sweetness. And I would puree that until it's really nice and smooth. Like a nice ricotta is already going to have a nice texture, but if you puree that in a food processor, you'll get those herbs and seasoning, the salt and stuff spread throughout, but it gets this really beautiful, rich, denser texture. And what I would do is take some baguette or other bread that you like, cut up and toast it. And there you go. So when it's time to serve, when people are showing up, you can take some of that nice ricotta mixture, spread it on the toast, put some of those cube squash on. And if you want to do a little like herb on top or maybe some pomegranate seeds on top with, for a nice, you know, sweet, pretty, acidic, sweet bite, and it'll look really beautiful. Or you can do bacon bits on top as well. And just have these little nice little roasted squash and ricotta toasts that like people can walk around. You can have one or two, make them pretty small so people can have one or two and feel like, oh, I have a nice snack, but not feel like they have to keep eating this thing, right? So they're not filling themselves up. They can sort of gauge their own hunger and just like put out a few trays of those or you can do other things on top of the toast. You can have a nice variety of toasts. But I think that's a nice finger food thing that won't necessarily fill people up. And can and so much of it you can do ahead of time.
Yes, no, that sounds great. So you just puree it and then just leave it in the refrigerator and then bring it out at room temperature?
Yeah, I mean, the toast you can leave at room temp. What I would do with the toast, too, is bake them at like 325 or 350 so they get really nice and dry and crisp and crunchy so they won't get soggy. And then you can leave those in an airtight container for a few days if you need, if you maybe want to refresh them in the oven so they're crisp again. You probably don't need to. The ricotta, you can certainly make a few days ahead and put it in the fridge. I would take it out maybe like an hour before you serve so it's not ice cold, you know, and so it'll spread nice and easy for you. And certainly the squash you can pre-make and you can put in the fridge and take it out also maybe an hour before. So that's a nice room temperature. Like I said, some bacon bits on top is probably going to be pretty delicious. Or some pomegranate seeds.
That sounds wonderful. This is great. I can't wait to try this.
Enjoy. And happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I'm getting hungry now thinking about it. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call, Alma.
Great. Happy Thanksgiving. Take care.
Happy Thanksgiving. Take care.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Okay, we have Elizabeth calling from Washington, D.C. Hey, Elizabeth, how are you?
I'm good, Francis. Thanks for taking my call.
A pleasure.
I am a fairly decent home cook. I don't mean that pejoratively, but I have this curse of cooking poultry, both chickens and turkeys. They're never done. They're always raw in the middle. And I'm trying to prepare for Thanksgiving this year. And my husband's like, can we just not do a turkey? I was like, no, we're gonna figure it out. So I mean, the only thing I can think of is that I normally try to buy an organic or free range bird at the farmer's market. Could that be what, do they take more time to cook? I don't brine. I mean, I don't know what's going on.
They are so free spirited that they're actually resisting your efforts to cook them. If the alternative then is the temptation to cook it further, then maybe you do want to think about brining. You said, I know you said you don't usually brine, but maybe brining would be a good thing so that you can put in the oven like a significant amount of time earlier than you need it. And if you have to err, then maybe you're erring more on the side of slightly overcooking rather than undercooking. And the brining will give you a little bit of insurance policy on that. It'll still be moist and juicy and yummy. The other thing I would say is, I mean, how committed are you to serving the bird whole?
Right. So my sister's actually a chef. She'd be so embarrassed I'm calling in. And she has been after
me for
is it spatchcock it, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that is totally terrifying. It sounds terrifying.
It's a gross word. But it's, I don't know where the word comes from, so I'm sorry if I'm insulting, you know, a culture. But yeah, the idea of spatchcocking is you cut the backbone out of the bird. With chicken, it's pretty easy if you have like heavy duty poultry shears. With turkey, you might have to like use a cleaver or something. But basically, you turn the bird so it's resting on its breast side and just go in through the back, through the cavity, and cut out the backbone on both sides. And then once that's out, you can sort of like open it up. In recipes, we usually say like a book. And then you flip the bird back over so it's now resting with its breast side up. And then you press gently but firmly on the breast, in the center of the breast, so the bird kind of lays flat. It'll sort of like crack open and lay flat for you. And what you're doing is you're increasing the surface area so much that it doesn't have to cook as long. So that's a really smart way to do it. And you can do it on high temperature so you can get a nice crisp skin. Usually when you're spatchcocking a chicken or a turkey, they say you can do it, you know, more like a 400, 425, maybe even 450 range rather than a 325 because you're not as concerned about overcooking the bird before the center gets cooked. So spatchcocking is a great way to do it. Or just go all out and cut it into pieces. You can maybe even ask whoever you're buying the turkey from, if you're buying it from a butcher, or, you know, have them take it into pieces for you. Legs, thighs, breasts.
That's a great idea, yeah.
Yeah, and you can roast them maybe, again, at a little bit of a higher heat, or roast them gently. I actually really like roasting it really gently, like 300, maybe even 275 till it's cooked, and then blasting it under the broiler or like blasting the heat up so to get the nice color on it afterwards. But like you've gently cooked it all the way through.
Yeah.
And then carve from there.
I think
that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get it chopped up and just cook it in pieces.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
You have so much more control over it.
So.
Yeah. Or brown it in a pan first and then roast it off in the oven, so you can get that nice color on the skin parts, and then do it in the oven, nice, like 325, 350 oven. So it's gentle and cooks all the way through.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you so much, Francis.
Cool. Well, enjoy. I hope you have the curse lifted.
Thank you, me too. Happy Thanksgiving.
Take care. All right, have a great Thanksgiving. Bye. And remember, we always love to hear from you. 1-800-537-5252. Or social media never sleeps, unfortunately. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, and let us know what you want to talk about. And speaking of something to talk about, let's say it's getting a little uncomfortably quiet at your Thanksgiving dinner and you could use a conversation starter. Well, anthropologist Logan Kistler's got your back just in time for the pie. Hey, Logan.
Hey, Francis. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so mathematically speaking, pumpkin pie is kind of a miracle, right? Like, meaning it's pretty weird that pumpkins and squashes are sweet and edible at all. Can you explain?
Yeah, to get into this, you kind of have to think about what pumpkins look like before there were pumpkins. So every food species that we eat, it's domesticated. It looks different. It's been under the influences of thousands of years of human evolution. And so pumpkins in the wild, they're about the size of tennis balls, and they're really tough. The rind is very thick. It's very difficult to open. And they taste terrible. They're really bitter. They actually contain the bitterest naturally occurring substances known to humans, and they're toxic.
Oh.
So it's not really a very attractive food stuff.
Yeah. So, but pumpkins are fruits, right? Meaning they have seeds. So they need animals to eat them, to break them open and get the seeds and, digest the fruit and then expel the seeds. So if they're gross tasting and they're toxic, how do they survive?
So they're gross tasting and toxic to humans and to small mammals. But if you rewind the clock about 15,000 years in the Americas, where these things grow wild, you had large herbivores, things like mastodons, woolly mammoths, and lots of these exotic large species that went extinct sort of at the end of the last ice age. And in Florida, there's actually deposits that are mastodon dung deposits that are full of 30,000-year-old mastodon dung. And if you look in there, sure enough, what we find are wild squash seeds. So it seems like these things that are bitter tasting and terrible to us actually had this relationship with wild or large mastodons and possibly other of these large plant-eating species, so they could disperse those. What we think this has to do with is body size and how much this animal has to eat. So if you're a mastodon, think of an elephant now. These are animals that have to eat approaching 200 pounds of food a day of plant matter. And so they're sort of wandering through the savannah or wandering through the forest, and they're just kind of vacuuming up everything in sight. They're really, really feeding on a lot of plant material, and they can't afford to be picky eaters. Okay. And so in evolutionary terms, when we taste something bitter, that signals to us that it's toxic. We're supposed to spit that out. That's how we detect dangerous compounds. But these very large animals, if they were detecting every slightly toxic compound, it wouldn't do them any good, because those don't pose so much of a threat when they're eating so much food. And in fact, it would actually be harmful to them. But if you look at something on the other end of the spectrum, look at a mouse or even small primates that eat a lot of different types of food, they're sampling throughout the environment, they're eating a lot of different kinds of plants, and a small amount of a toxic substance could be really harmful. And so actually, large animals have a greater tolerance for bitterness than small ones do. So even though this sort of tennis ball-shaped, horrible-tasting thing is no good to us, it's very attractive to large mammals.
So what happened then? Mastodons eventually died off. What came to love these things then?
Yeah, so mastodons, they were part of a lot of extinction events that happened in the Americas around sort of 10 to 12 to 15,000 years ago. And this is a combination of factors. Humans are showing up sort of around this time, and they're certainly hunting some of these animals. In addition to that, there are climate change events going on at that time. So the ecosystem is essentially changing too fast, and these large mammals go extinct. In fact, there's none of these really, really huge herbivores left in North or South America now. But so after these things wink out in what we call the end of the Pleistocene, then the squashes have a problem. They don't have a disperser anymore. And not only that, but these wild plants prefer disturbed landscapes. And elephants, you know, when they're feeding on 100 or 200 pounds of food a day, they're really affecting the landscape.
Sorry, by disturbed landscape, you mean like literally, oh, the elephants are huge. Mastodons are huge.
Yep.
And they're just like squashing stuff.
They are shredding the landscape. They're eating a lot of stuff in sight. And we can see this. We can look at, for example, pollen from lake cores going through thousands of years. And when you see large herbivores disappear, you see a change in the forest composition. You get these much more homogeneous sort of landscapes that are much more similar to what we see now.
Oh, interesting. And then so how do they become something that, I mean, you know, fast forward, spoiler alert, we love to eat these things now. How did they come to be something that humans love eating?
So essentially because humans also mess around with the landscape, you know, we clear space for growing food. You know, we clear space around houses for protection. We really do change the ecosystem around us. And that's kind of a substitute environment for these wild plants. So these wild plants kind of cozy up to humans beginning around 10,000 years ago. And this doesn't happen once. It happens on six different occasions throughout North and South America. And so they sort of enter into this evolutionary partnership with humans, where humans are providing a environment in which these wild plants can grow. But then this whole relationship goes a step farther, because humans still can't use this plant at this time. It's still bitter and toxic. But the plant then makes a few evolutionary concessions. So whereas being tough and bitter was a good characteristic for their purposes in the company of mastodons, it doesn't work for humans. And so they lose that hard rind and they develop soft flesh and they lose that toxicity and become sweet. So over time, the evolution of those characters benefits those plants in the long run because it makes them more attractive to humans, who then plant them year on year and provide a favorable environment that they can thrive in.
Yeah. So at some point, like some great ancestor found one of these wild squashes that, oh, this one doesn't make me feel terrible when I eat it. So they ate it and they took those seeds and maybe those seeds were dispersed. And so those grew and more people found that one. And so it was like there was one random mutation and then humans sort of glommed onto that. And then, like you said, there was this sort of like evolutionary, I guess symbiosis isn't the word. What would you call that when you're sort of like partners in evolution?
Symbiosis is exactly the word.
Oh, really? Right on.
Yeah,
good
that's
job,
exactly
lamb.
How it would
So it becomes this evolutionary symbiosis, and eventually we have pumpkins that are sweet and delicious and show up in our pies on Thanksgiving.
That's exactly right.
That's so fascinating.
And at the beginning of that process, that's one of the sort of black boxes left. So we don't really know what that first, tasty pumpkin looked like or how the first parts of that process got underway. It might have been for the seeds. They're a little bit less bitter. We also have archaeological situations where people were using these wild squashes to float fish nets. So they're using them in other ways and using them as containers before they can eat them. And then, it's exactly like you say. Somebody perhaps happens on one that's a little bit more palatable, and then they kind of influence that over time into what we have now.
Yeah. Now we mix it with a whole pile of spices and forget what the pumpkin tastes like anyway.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Logan. This is super, super interesting.
Thanks for having me.
Logan Kistler is a curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. And if now you feel like eating pumpkins, you can go to splendidtable.org and get a great recipe from Donna Hay for roasted pumpkin and chorizo salad. And that is our show for the week. Don't forget to join us for Turkey Confidential live on Thanksgiving Day. We'll be here for you with open phone lines and open hearts. 2 hours of live triage on the cookingest day of the year from noon to 2 Eastern. This year's guests are Samin Nosrat, Melissa Clark, Kwame Onwuachi, and Shauna Seaver. It is a ton of fun. We'll talk to you next week. Take a look at splendidtable.org. To search for a recipe, register for a weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, check out our videos, and subscribe to our podcast. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell, Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director, Erica Romero is our associate producer, Chip Walton is our digital producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.